I think all the rest of the committee's off having dinner without me. They ditch me. So why don't we do this? What I'd like, the way I'd like to start this, I call this Kitchen Table AA, and it's about sponsorship primarily. And every one of us that came into Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon, somebody was kind to us. Somebody got us a cup of coffee, told us what was going on, saved us a chair, remembered our name the second time we came back. Maybe that person or people, one of them ended up being our sponsor that took us through the steps. So when we start this off with a moment of silence and then the serenity prayer, let's try and picture in our mind who it was that greeted us and was kind to us and just took a few minutes. Usually we don't remember what they say, but we sure remember how they felt to us. Let's try and get in touch with that just for a moment. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. One of the guys I remember about that was a man by the name of Larry Larkin. Great big guy. Used to be a local bartender in the beach area, so a lot of people knew him, and he knew everybody. And one night, I stood out in the parking lot with this man. I didn't know him at all. And he talked to me for 45 minutes. We just stood out there and talked. And I didn't go home right away after the meeting like I'd been doing. He kind of cornered me and talked to me. And I always thought, I went home that night really feeling good, like he really had an interest in me. Later I found that Larry would talk to anybody. I just happened to be the one he captured, you know. But God knows how many lives that man saved because he was like that. A little history. I mean, you've had some history if you watched Wally and listened to Mel, which was just excellent. And I really enjoy Wally's stuff. And it's been really interesting meeting Mel and talking about that history and where we came from. Sponsorship, as you'll hear many people say, is not mentioned in the big book. That's not true. Wally made the caveat that it's not in the first 164 pages. That's true. But if you read the stories, it's all over it. The Oxford group used the term sponsorship freely. It's where the term came from. It's how they operated. Henrietta Seeberling was Ann Smith's sponsor. And when Ebbie Thatcher came from the Oxford group to look for Bill Wilson, he did that at the guidance of his sponsor, Roland Hazard. And he went and found the worst drunk he knew, which was Bill Wilson. My sponsor is a historian and an archivist, and he talks about the time that when Wilson went back looking for Ebbie and he was drunk, the guy that was standing by the door at Calvary Chapel, Calvary Mission, wouldn't let him in because he was so drunk. Now, you have to keep in mind that what he was trying to get into was a room where they were preaching to a bunch of drunken street people. So Wilson must have been roaring drunk if they wouldn't let him in, because there was already a room full of them in there. So on a scale of 1 to 10, he must have been pretty polluted. And Ebbie saw him by the door, and he said to this man, Shep, that was by the door, "It's okay. I will sponsor him in." And that term sponsorship was used as you had somebody that would vouch for you. And you got to remember, in those days, people weren't showing up to AA meetings. Number one, there weren't any. And later, when there were some meetings, nobody knew where they were. People weren't, you know, they weren't dropping them off to go to the AA meeting. Guys' wives weren't saying, you need to go to a meeting. You know, they didn't know anything about it. So what these guys would do is they would go to the hospitals and they would recruit people. They'd go from bed to bed and say, are you ready to quit drinking? And if they'd say no, they'd move on to the next bed. And that guy would then bring that person when he got out of the hospital to the AA meeting and became his sponsor, would vouch for him and say, this guy's cool, he wants to stop drinking, let's talk to him. So fast forward a little bit. In 1939, they came out with the Big Book. Now, the motivation for the Big Book, if you know any of the history at all, is Wilson needed to raise money. All of them did. As they were all sitting around talking, they go, what are we going to do with this thing? We're working our butts off here. If this thing's going to grow, we're going to have to come up with some capital. Well, the first idea is, well, let's publish a book. Let's print a book. And if they know, people know the book is coming out and is going to hit the country by storm, we can sell stock certificates to raise money based upon the publishing of the book. So they printed some worthless stock certificates and sold them for $25 a piece, which was a lot of money in 1939. As Wally pointed out, I mean, the cost of the book would be like $100 today. They were charging $5 for that book in 1939, which was a lot of money. It's not the $5 of today. You know, that sometimes you put that in the basket because it just doesn't have as much value as it did. So they were looking for a lot of money, and this book was the source of that. So when they passed the book around between the people in Akron and New York, they edited it. And they took out, if you've ever heard one of the early lithographs of Chapter 5 where it talks about rules and directions and you will and it doesn't say we, they softened it. They softened it from the reality that they knew to try to be attractive to bring people in. And they changed some of it. They softened it up. Fortunately. So they publish the book. The book goes out. They get some response. They're basically disappointed. They had to pay all the people their money back for the phony stock certificates. And then Bob Smith wrote a document, probably had a little bit of help, but I think it's mostly him, called the Akron Manual. And the Akron Manual, depending upon who you talk to or how you look it up, was either printed in 1940 or 1941. They made this document up after the Big Book was written, after the language of recovery had been established, which they didn't really know for sure, but that book, we quote that thing chapter and verse, page number, paragraph, it's like it's a Bible. And you got to keep in mind, it's a pointer at best, and it was a sales tool. And this Akron Manual, I think, more describes what they were actually doing. Now, I'm not promoting this as the way that it should be, because it really kind of cracks me up. I think, as Wally says, you need to know where you're coming from, where you came from. This is where we came from. This is what these guys knew. You got to remember, around this time, they weren't allowing women in AA. Dr. Bob came home one day and found some guy and some girl having sex on his examination table at the home. Their immediate response to that was, that's it, no more women. See what they do? You know, a bit chauvinistic, you know. Why did I bring that up? Anyway, I'm going to read you a few excerpts from the Akron Manual. Once again, I'm not promoting this as how it should be, but this gives you an idea where these guys were and how they felt about sponsorship and about what the core and the crux of the program was. So I'll just read you a few excerpts. This is from page 2. Explain that we are not in the business of sobering up drunks merely to have them go on another bender. Explain that our aim is total and permanent sobriety. Not once does it mention in this document one day at a time. Not once. They don't even allude to it. Definition of an Alcoholic Anonymous. An Alcoholic Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application of and adherence to the rules laid down by the organization, has completely forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages. The moment he wittingly drinks so much as a drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic drink, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain completely sober for all time. You're out of here. No slippers. No slippers allowed. To the newcomer, it is your life. It is your choice. If you are not completely convinced to your own satisfaction that you are an alcoholic, that your life has become unmanageable, if you are not ready to part with alcohol forever, it would be better for all concerned if you discontinue reading this and give up the idea of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Loser. A word to the sponsor. You must fulfill all pledges you make to him, either tangible or intangible. If you cannot fulfill a promise, do not make it. You have in your hands the most valuable property in the world, the future of a fellow man. Treat his life as carefully as you would your own. You are literally responsible for his life. That's how serious these guys were. Alcoholics Anonymous is 100% effective for those who faithfully follow the rules. It is those who try to cut corners who find themselves back in their old drunken state. Rules. Before long, you will have a new thrill, the thrill of helping someone else. There is no greater satisfaction in the world than watching the progress of a new Alcoholic Anonymous. No whiskey in the world can give you this thrill. Above all, remember this. Keep the rules in mind. As long as you follow them, you are on firm ground, but the least deviation and you are vulnerable. As a new member, remember that you are one of the most important cogs in the machinery of AA. Without the work of the new member, AA would not have grown as it has. You will bring into this work a fresh enthusiasm, the zeal of a crusader. You will want everyone to share with you the blessings of this new life. You will be tireless in your efforts to help others, and it is a splendid enthusiasm. Cherish it as long as you can. For you are ready to sponsor some poor alcoholic who is desperately in need of help, both human and divine. So God bless you and keep you. Here's one of my favorite parts of this. This is just killer. I could just imagine these guys sitting around coming up with this. You aren't very important in this world. If you lose your job, someone better will replace you. If you die, your wife will mourn briefly and then remarry. Your children will grow up and you will be but a memory. In the last analysis, you are the only one who benefits by your sobriety. Seek to cultivate humility. Remember that cockiness leads to a speedy fall. They had issues. There must have been a couple of arrogant people around there then. Medical men will tell you that alcoholics are all alike in at least one respect. They are emotionally immature. In other words, alcoholics have not learned to think like adults. That's a little rough. At meetings, don't criticize the leader. They were already, people were bitching about the leader and bitching about the meetings. Already. I love that. He has his own problems and is doing the best to solve them. Help him along by standing up and saying a few words. He will appreciate your kindness and thoughtfulness. Don't criticize the methods of others. Strangely enough, you may change your own ideas as you become older in sobriety. Remember, there are a dozen roads from New York to Chicago, but they all land in Chicago. How soon you will be cured of a desire to drink is another matter. That depends entirely upon how quickly you can succeed in changing your fundamental outlook on life. For as your outlook changes for the better, desire will become less pronounced until it disappears almost entirely. It may be weeks or it may be months. Your sincerity and your capacity for working with others on the AA program will determine the length of time. Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a set of laws known as the 12 steps. Laws. Years of experience have definitely proved that those who live up to these rules remain sober. Those who gloss over or ignore any one rule are in constant danger of returning to a life of drunkenness. Thousands of words could be written on each rule. Lack of space prevents, so they are merely listed here. It is suggested that they be explained by the sponsor. If he cannot explain them, he should provide someone who can. That's the Akron Manual. I've got a sign-up sheet here. If you want to put your... I'm going to be reading some other documents and stuff. If you'd like to get copies of this, I'd be happy to email it to you. You can put your name, email address, phone number, and city and state, and I'd be happy to do that. I've got some cards here you can get, and for the tape, if you play this later, my email address is billc@kitchentableaa.com. And my phone number is 310-792-8013. So you can sign up on the list. And I also send out like daily quotes and from different sources, not all big book stuff. And no chain emails, no dirty jokes, unless you specifically request that. So that kind of sets the stage. What these guys were doing is they were sponsoring each other. Now, there's this thing that you hear that we had a 75% success rate, and now it's less than 5%, or whoever, whatever doomsayer that you listen to, that percentage changes. And they're coming. They're coming. It's the mothership. So, not recently, in 2008, a bunch of AA guys got together and they put together this Alcoholics Anonymous Recovery Outcome Rates Contemporary Myth and Misinterpretation. When you look back in the past and you try to come up with what the percentage is, usually this number, 75%, comes from the forward to the second edition in the big book. Wilson rarely used that. Probably it was closer to 30 or 40%. When they said the first 100 guys that helped write the book, there were only 77. They lied to us up front. Most of the people that wrote the stories in the first edition of the big book, a good percentage of them, drank again. Several committed suicide. They had the same problem we had. And they screened them before they came to the meetings. They screened them. We don't do that, nor do we have the luxury of doing that, nor do I think it would be a good idea if we did that. Times have changed. The operative term in that phrase, when you hear that, is of those who really tried. What do they mean by really tried? When they talk about the 50% that stayed sober and the 25% that got sober and stayed sober after a slip or two, of those who really tried, what are they talking about? Well, there's some CDs over there that I noticed the first time I've ever seen them of Tom Powers. Tom Powers was a guy who recently passed away. He was quite old. And he helped Bill put together the 12 and 12. He split off from AA because he felt that Bill had issues, that Tom got a resentment. And he ran off and he started in upstate New York an organization that's still around today called All Addictions Anonymous. And his son, Tom Powers Jr., some years later in the 60s, got sober. And he wrote a really interesting document in the 70s called Gresham's Law and Alcoholics Anonymous. Gresham's Law is an economic term, and it says that bad money will chase out good money in the market if they're valued the same. And I won't go into detail about that. You can read this and see. I'll send it to you. But in this, he talks about, he equates this to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's talking about what he sees as a bad entity, a bad movement within AA that is chasing out the good. That's his analysis. And he describes it. And in it, he describes the three levels of involvement in AA. He kind of equates it, in one document I saw, he equates it to like a medium, weak, and strong cup of coffee kind of a thing. And I'm just going to read you quickly, the kind of paraphrase it a little bit, his description of strong, medium, and weak involvement or effort. Strong. Strong AA was the original undiluted dosage of spiritual principles. Strong AAs took all 12 steps and kept on taking them. They did not stop with the admission of powerlessness over alcohol, but went right on, right away, to turn their wills and lives over to God's care. They began to practice rigorous honesty in all their affairs. In short order, they proceeded to take a moral inventory, admit all their wrongs to at least one other person, take positive and forceful action in making such restitution as was possible for those wrongs, continued taking inventory, admitting their faults, and making restitution on a regular basis. Pray and meditate every day, go to two or more AA meetings weekly, and actively work the 12 step, carrying the AA message to others in trouble. Medium. All of us have done medium. The medium AA started off with a bang, pretty much like the strong AAs, except they hedged or procrastinated a bit on parts of the program they feared or did not like. Maybe the God steps, maybe the inventory steps, depending on their particular nervousness or dislikes. Take what you can use and leave the rest. But after they had stayed sober for a while, the medium AAs eased up and settled into a practice of the program that went something like this. An AA meeting a week, occasional 12-step work, leaving more and more of that to the newer fellows as time went on. Some work with the steps, but not like before. Less and less inventory as they became more and more respectable. Some prayer and meditation still, but not on a daily basis anymore. Not enough time due to the encroachment of business engagements, social activities, and other baggage that went along with the return to a normal life in the workaday world. Weak. The weak AAs are a varied lot. The thing common to all of them was that they left big chunks of the program totally and permanently out of their reckoning right from the outset, sometimes the God steps, sometimes the inventory steps, often both. Weak AAs tended to talk in terms like all you need to do is stay sober, is go to meetings and stay away from the first drink. Most of the weak AAs who were successful in staying sober were pretty faithful meeting goers. Since they were doing so little with the principles, their sobriety and their survival depended more exclusively than did those of the strong and medium AAs on constant exposure to the people of AA. That's Gresham's Law. Now, here's what I see in AA along those lines. There's a whole group or class of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have come to believe that doing AA is going to meetings. That's AA. Doing AA is go to lots of meetings. Don't drink in between. And what you see when you go to meetings where people are sharing about how their day went constantly, and it's that kind of a group therapy sort of thing that many of us complain about, or we see that as this encroaching death knell of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people that are doing that don't have sponsors. Or maybe they have a sponsor that they're not talking to, that they're not working the steps with. Or maybe their sponsor's sitting next to them in the meeting, and that's what their sponsor is doing them, is bringing them to meetings. And this is what we do here. This is what we do. If they had a sponsor to share about these issues in their life with, or they had a group of friends even that they could do that with, they wouldn't do it in the meetings. There'd be no need to do it in the meetings. If there's a strong ethic of sponsorship in an AA community, the meetings will reflect that ethic. And the people that are singing the death knell of AA, Usually the approach is we need to change the meetings. There needs to be rules. People shouldn't say this, they should say that. There shouldn't be so many discussion meetings. There should be more book studies. You know, in the past, they didn't have discussion meetings like this. You know, this is killing people. People are dying because they're not getting the message. I disagree with that. I don't think we can control the meetings. Our traditions tell us that every meeting is autonomous. And who am I to say what somebody needs as a doorway into Alcoholics Anonymous? And I know for a fact that the message isn't in the meetings anyway. The message comes from me. The message comes from the sponsor. The message comes from the person that you ask to help you through the process. It's not in the meetings. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is something to be survived. This is the character defect center of the known universe. I mean, you'll hit on my wife, you'll borrow money from me, and you won't pay me back. I'll give you a job, you'll do a crappy job, and somehow it'll be my fault. That's my personal favorite. Then you won't show up to my birthday party after all I've done for you. No. And when the meetings are comprised of the fellowship. Now, my home group, the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, the epicenter of sobriety, is different, of course, as I'm sure your home group is as well. But there's this whole focus on what the meetings should look like, what we should say there, and what we should do. And I just disagree with it. I think the meetings is where we find each other. That's where we go to. We find each other there. And if somebody's really looking for help, you know, it's our job to seek that person out. My wife took her little nephew that got court ordered to go to AA meetings. He's really happy about that. And she took him to a 4 o'clock in the afternoon meeting in our local Alano Club. They have 5 meetings a week. They call themselves the Happy Retreads, which will give you some indication of the content in this meeting. And she had never been to one of these. I was on the board at the Alano Club, so I'd had to suffer through a few. And she went there and she came back and her mouth was open. She goes, "That was appalling. I've never seen anything like that in my life. It was horrible. It was just horrible." And I said, I just laughed. I said, "What did you do?" She goes, "I raised my hand and shared." You know, I said, "What did you do to those poor people?" And she just talked about recovery. Talked about recovery. And but I don't know what your doorway should be, you know, or what it's going to be. You know, I mean, we've joked for years about noon meetings, you know, and noon meetings are for people that don't have jobs. Night meetings are real AA meetings, you know. Daytime meetings, I don't know what those are. Morning meetings are very weird. What are people doing going to AA first thing in the morning? And they hold hands and sing. I was in general service, and somebody came into the GSR meeting at District 1, Area 9, and were complaining. She says, "In the morning meetings at the Alano Club, they're singing. You have to come stop them from singing." And you just roar, you know. I mean, there's got to be rules and laws. Everybody wants to make a rule or a law, you know. One of the beauties of Alcoholics Anonymous is it's just anarchy. You know, it always was. You can see it in the Akron Manual. They're bitching about, you know, don't blame the meeting, don't talk about other people. It's already starting. You know. I believe what the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous is sponsorship. I believe very strongly on a couple of different levels why that is. I believe it's the mechanism that the manager uses to cause us to confront our defects of character, to hone us, to give us the experiences it takes for us to deepen emotionally. That without this process, we will never confront those things. It won't come up in any other way. And we make excuses for it. We say, "Well, I do other things besides that." there is nothing else you can do that will take the place of that. That's all these men did in the 30s and 40s and 50s. When my dad got sober in 1954, that's what he did. That's what they had him doing. He was going out on 12-step calls. He was bringing, I have many memories of him bringing some stranger into the house and bringing him into the living room, and I'd have to leave the living room while they pounded on the book and pointed their finger at him and told him the same lame-ass stuff we tell him today. Not much has changed. You know, I don't believe the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed much. Not the program. I'm talking about the program, the 12 steps. There they are. A lot of other stuff has come into AA. Some of it's, I think, very positive. We've learned a lot over the years about alcoholism. We've learned a lot. You know, people talk about going back to what it was like. Tom Ivester, that's been quoted here a couple of times this weekend, told me, he says, there were no good old times. These are the good old times. He says, everybody talks about those glory days. He says, I don't ever want to have somebody having a seizure in my car next to me ever again. He says, it scared the hell out of me. It was horrible. I thought the man was going to die, and I didn't know what to do. He says, we don't want him having seizures in the AA meetings anymore. We talk about it like it's some kind of nostalgia, like it's really fun, like it's cute or something. He says, it's not cute. I remember that. It was awful. It was frightening. We didn't know what to do. You know, Bill Wilson wanted hospitals across the country. Remember, he went to Rockefeller, wanted to get money, wanted to build hospitals across the country. We have that now. Recovery is available at all levels of society. The reason the kids are coming in is the parents today have an option. When they see their child dying from methamphetamine usage, they can grab them, have them shipped off to Utah where they hang them upside down from a tree and beat them with birch twigs for 6 months or so to give them the outdoor experience and do a little behavior modification. Then all you people ship them out to California to these goddamn places that send them to our meetings. The kids are coming in because recovery is part of our lexicon today. It's not a bad thing. This is a good thing. This is what Wilson wanted. My father and Chuck Chamberlain and a bunch of other guys in the 60s were working on a project that Bill called the Big 12th Step. And the whole idea was to get back to Washington, D.C. somehow and get the government to recognize alcoholism as a disease along with the American Medical Association so they would quit incarcerating us and put us into recovery, to get the insurance industry to come on board and start funding recovery facilities rather than putting us out on the street or in prison. And when that happened, when the recovery industry raised up and began doing that, it set off an adversarial relationship between Alcoholics Anonymous and the professional community. We did not handle it well. We still bitch about them to this day. We call them spin dries, and they dump addicts on our AA meetings. We snivel and whine and cry about it constantly. And when I came in the mid-80s, people would sit in the meetings and read newspaper articles about the atrocity of these recovery places and all the money they're making. And all the alcoholics were going there getting jobs, you know. And everybody was complaining about it. And I came through a recovery place and I came walking in there and I felt like you didn't want me. But I'm big enough and arrogant enough and loud enough that I just took it as a challenge, you know. And now in my home group, when these kids are coming in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years that it's been happening, most of the old guys in my meeting that I got sober with have left because they say, we're not a daycare center. What are all these kids doing here? I mean, it's appalling. It's appalling, the attitude. Isn't this what we want? Wouldn't we rather them come in and get sober at 16, 17, 18 rather than spend another 10 or 15 years out there killing themselves and someone else? It's not about you feeling comfortable in the goddamn meeting. It's about recovery. And the meetings aren't AA. Whew. It's just my opinion, but it's a really good one. My sponsor, when I asked him for help, he told me to come to his house Thursday at 5 o'clock and read the doctor's opinion and make notes in the margin of what I agreed with and what I didn't agree with. And I did that. And then he had me sit there and read it to him. And each week when I went there, we had an hour to an hour and a half. He was working. He was married. His wife had just gotten sober. And we read the book together all the way to the end. Not the stories, but to the end of the 164. And he worked the steps with me. He sent me home to do my inventory, and I suffered and whined about it for a while, like Wally talks about, you know, it only takes 10 minutes. Well, we've evolved, I think, a little bit beyond the 10-minute four-step inventory, I would hope. And I did my inventory, and I did my fifth step, and I felt like a member of AA after that. I had a distinct impression like I'd really joined this thing. And I went about the process of making amends. And before I was a year sober, I was sponsoring my first guy at his direction. Another thing he told me, he says, you can't be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if your name is not on the 12-step list down at the central office. I thought that's where they handed out the ID badges. So I ran right down there and signed up. You know, I didn't wait for him to send me a form. I was scared to death that And I was motivated by self. I've always been motivated by self. I wanted to look good. I figured if I was going to be an AA, I might as well be the biggest, baddest member of AA there is. I'm trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization, you know. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I don't think it's really healthy. But it's part of the growing up process, isn't it? I mean, if we wait around for good motivation, we'll wait forever. You know, I mean, you just got to get in there and get your hands dirty. And the motivation will change as the behavior changes. So when I started sponsoring guys, I did the same thing he did with me. And to this day, it's still pretty much the same format. But I've learned a lot since then in 24 years. I've learned a lot. I think I'm a better sponsor. I don't know if my success rate is any better, but I can tell you my personal success rate is probably better than 75 or 80%. Is that of everybody that asks me to sponsor them? No. It's of those who really try. The ones that don't disappear at the four step. The ones that don't cop an attitude with me. You know, I've had to tell guys, I go, you don't want what I have. I don't fire guys, but I tell them, I'll look at me, you don't want what I have. Why, what do you say that? Because you don't do what I do. You know, you don't do what I do. Why? What are we doing here? What do you call this? You keep calling me your sponsor. Really? You know, what are you doing? Are you working this? You know, and the answer is, of course, no. But they can walk around and go, Bill C's my sponsor. You know. What does that mean? You know, Jay Stinnett's my sponsor, you know. But if I never call him, what good is he? If I'm not working steps with him, what good is he? If I don't bring my stuff to him, what good is he? I don't have a sponsor if I'm not actually using him, if I don't have a relationship with him. So over the years, my approach to people has changed. And here's one significant one. One of the things you hear in AA is you'll hear people from the podium say in different ways, they'll say, I'm a sick puppy and I hope I never get well. That I'm not recovered, I'm recovering, and that will never stop. You know, I've got the ism. It's not alcohol anymore, but I've got the ism. I've got alcoholic thinking. I heard one guy one time, we used to have a local guy that was 30, 40 years sober, and he'd say, I'm living proof that you can stay angry and still be sober. And I go, God, now there's something to shoot for, you know? But I want what he's got. His AA nickname was Rotten Ron. You know, I mean, geez. So we have a tendency to tell people in many different ways that you're broken. You're broken. You're an alcoholic. You're broken. And we're going to heal you here. I don't do that anymore. I look them right in the eye and tell them you are not broken. You're just fine. You couldn't have come here any other way than the way you are. This is your path, and you're on the path, and you're with us now. You're going to be okay, man. And you're okay right now, right here, right now. There's nothing wrong. And I believe that to the bottom of my heart. You know, all of us get here with a lot of regret and a lot of remorse and some guilt and some shame, and some of us more than others. But that was our path. Our greatest weakness becomes our greatest strength. That story is like gold. People will attach themselves to us because of that story. And especially if we heal from it, if we recover from it. I'm not a sick puppy anymore. I'm not a childish, immature little boy anymore. I'm not. I have self-esteem. I feel pretty good about what I see. I have no secrets from anybody, which is kind of embarrassing sometimes, you know. But I have no more secrets. Everybody knows everything, you know. I mean, what do I have to protect? You can't take anything from me that I wouldn't give you, you know. You can't hurt me. You can't injure me. And every time my heart breaks, it breaks open. I've recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that there's more to come. I look at guys ahead of me, and I see that glint in their eyes. I see men that are 70, 75, 80 years old that have a very childlike demeanor about them and that glint in their eye, you know, and they're still sponsoring guys and they're sponsoring kids and they're having a great life, you know, along with liver problems and kidneys and all that crap that comes with age, you know. But life is still good. That's the gift that we have here in AA. And I try to carry that in my when I'm working with guys. But I do the same thing. You know, I read the book with them. I sit and I read the book. We read Bill's story again and again and again, you know, over and over and over. And I put together little groups and I use a handbook that we go through and we all go through the steps together. It takes about 6 months. You know, try to mix up the curriculum a little bit to keep it interesting, to keep their interest and to keep my interest as well. You know, and if you invite me into your life, I'll come. And I will invite you into my life. And you have to make the choice whether you really want to come, if you really want this. One of the rules that you kind of hear that is debated is men work with men and women work with women. I was doing this kind of a workshop thing and I brought this up because I feel very strongly about that. I think it's important that men work with men and women work with women. And I know that there's a lot of guys that sponsor women. And I heard this one guy say, he says, look, I live in a rural area where there aren't many men and women in AA. And when women come in and they need help, I can't tell them no. And my wife knows about it. I make sure I'm not alone with him. You know, he had his rules that he lived by. And I stood there and I could not argue with that guy. There was no argument if it was like that. But I live in Los Angeles. And you'll hear this thing that there aren't women that work the steps, that I can't find any women that work the steps. Well, I have a list. You know, I have a list. And I used to turn them down flatly with some cute little aside. And I don't do that anymore. I tell them, I said, you can call me anytime you want. I'm there for you. I'd be happy to talk to you. You know, but I'm not going to help you hide from your own kind. Because I believe that's what happens. You know, women will manipulate us if they can. Men will manipulate women if they can. But women are much slicker at it. You know, and they've been getting along forever doing this. And we are just dead meat. We aren't sophisticated enough to pick up on it. I used to think they all wanted to sleep with me. Why do you laugh? And then I realized I was a father figure. And then I realized I'm a grandfather figure. Evidently, they think I'm safe. Which is kind of sad when you think about it, you know. I don't like being perceived as safe. You know, but I'm not going to help you hide from your own kind. Men do the same thing. You know, men do the same thing. My wife is one of those women that works the steps. She's also one of those women that did not want to go to women's meetings. She didn't want to do that. She didn't want anything to do with that. And her sponsor finally made her go, made her come and pick her up, and she started going to a women's meeting. And now she's the maven, you know. And they do cool stuff, like when it's birthday week, you know. She'll buy little dolls, and they wear hats, and they have. And I tried to introduce that at the men's stag, and they just, you know, they rub on each other and stuff. You know, I thought that would be nice, you know, get in touch with our feminine side, you know. I don't fire you. I didn't hire you, so I don't get to fire you. If I'm going to confront my defects of character, I'm going to have to learn how to deal with you, not just send you away. One of the things when Jay and I, my sponsor, when we do this together, and we've got some PowerPoint stuff and stuff that we do, and we go more into the history, and sometimes we'll do a weekend-long thing about this. Essentially, what we do is we describe our relationship that we've had for 24 years. And there have been times where I wanted to fire him, where he treated me miserably. And on one particular occasion, he embarrassed me. He said something that I really felt that I didn't deserve. And I was bitching about him to another guy that he sponsored. We were having great pleasure just eviscerating the little bastard, you know, as we were standing there talking about him. And this guy, John, looked at me. He goes, "Why don't you go tell him?" I went, "Whoa. That's a little scary." Because, see, I'm the phony, tough guy. I'm the one with the clip-on earring. It's real easy for me to be a badass in public, you know, because I'm big and I can humiliate you in front of other people. And I'll do that. You know, I'll mess with you in front of other people. I'll shame you and I'll confront you and scare you, you know, as long as other people are watching. But alone, one-on-one, I'm impotent. You know, nobody's watching. There's no audience. And I'm scared, because essentially I'm afraid of you, is what the truth is. So I had to go back to him and confront him alone, without other people around, and tell him how I felt, which is really hard to do. And I cornered him outside this meeting. I took him aside and I said, "You know, what you said to me last week, I really don't think I deserve that. You really hurt my feelings. You know, and I would appreciate it if you wouldn't talk to me like that anymore. I don't think I deserve it." And he stood there in front of me. His eyes got really big and he started to cry, which completely screwed me up. I mean, I'm ready for the fight. You know, I knew we weren't going to punch it out. I outweigh him by about 400 pounds. And, you know, but I knew that there was going to be an argument. He was going to defend himself. Of course he would defend himself. And he stood there in front of me with tears in his eyes, and he apologized to me. He says, "You know, you're right. I should have never said that to you. I was having a bad day, and I'm really sorry. I apologize. It was never my intent to hurt you." And it completely screwed me up. I didn't know what to do with that. I felt kind of embarrassed for him. You know, it was a weird, I had a weird reaction to the whole thing. But it completely changed our relationship. And he taught me another lesson. He taught me how to be honest. How to take responsibility for your own behavior. I also learned that there can be conflict in a relationship, and that doesn't mean the relationship is over. I don't know these things. When did I ever learn these things? Never. Guys come to me and they say, "I want you to be my sponsor. Joe doesn't have time for me." And I say, "Well, I know Joe. He seems like a pretty good guy. What do you mean he doesn't have time?" "Well, God, he's married and he's got kids." He goes, oh, you mean he's got a life?" "Okay, yeah, that's the Joe I know. He has like a real life." And he said, "But he just doesn't have time for me. He doesn't return my calls and stuff like that." And I said, "Why don't you do this? Why don't you go tell Joe how you feel? Because have you talked to him about this?" "No." "Why don't you go tell Joe how you feel? And then come back and we'll talk." They never come back. Never. One of two things happens. They either go talk to Joe and they solve the problem, because Joe will stand right in front of him and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, man. What do you want to get together?" "Sure. Let's make a date. Let's make a time." Because you know there's more to the story. You know, what's happening is the guy's calling. He's not saying, "Call me back." So Joe's a busy guy. He doesn't call back. He gets the message. He just hangs up, you know. Well, we take that personally, like you don't care, you know. And they either talk to Joe and they resolve the problem, or they move on and ask somebody else that won't require them to go talk to Joe. Because the last thing they want to do is go talk to Joe. Because it's too real. It's too real. So this relationship with my sponsor is probably the single most significant relationship I've ever had in my life because of these lessons that I learned through interaction with him. So you don't fire him. You got to deal with him. But not firing him doesn't mean that you have to be nice to him. You know, you can tell him the truth. You can look at him right in the eye and say, you don't want what I have. You're not doing what I do. Should everybody sponsor?
Yes.
You say yes?
Yeah.
Anybody else? Should everybody sponsor people?
Everybody.
No, there's a no over here. Why no? Because some people do not make good sponsors. You're right. But how do I know that some guy doesn't need a bad sponsor?
You
know? I mean, there's a group of people that I like to call the parking lot people. They're the people out in the parking lot smoking cigarettes and drinking Red Bulls, and they're not coming into the meeting. They're the parking lot people, you know? And if you go and you ask one of these parking lot people to be your sponsor, from the outside, well, that's not a good move. What's this guy know? He's never worked the steps. He's got nothing. But if you've got two parking lot people that are out there, and one of them asks the other parking lot person to be their sponsor, maybe the parking lot guy will come into the meeting to get some information, you know, to try to stay ahead of the other loser that just asked him to sponsor him. I'm not running the show. I'm powerless. I think everybody should sponsor. Now, I get a lot of back and forth. You know, sometimes we'll do a lot of Q&A about this. And if you'd like to pipe up, raise your hand. But the reason I believe that is, and you hear people say, well, I just don't have anything to offer. Low self-esteem, lack of self-confidence. How do you address that? How do you address that? I'm intimidated by people. I'm not real social. I'm kind of an introvert. I think that's a character defect. You know? How do you address that? How does it come out? How do you get beyond that? Now, my experience is just the opposite. I'm very social. I started sponsoring people because I wanted to look good. My total motivation was to look good. And I wanted to be the biggest, baddest AA dude in town. And I'm gathering a flock, right? You know, I'm gathering people up, you know, to do this thing. And you know, most of this is unconscious. I'm just doing what I'm doing. This is all hindsight, looking in hindsight. Well, the time comes when you're sitting in a room with a guy and you give him a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life, and he leaves the room and you say to yourself, man, that's good shit. I should try some of that. What's that? You know, at best, it's hypocrisy. At worst, it's lying. I mean, you're painting the picture that you're actually doing this. I'm full of it. I'm the phony biker, and now I'm the phony AA guru. I'm giving you all the great advice because I've got good language skills, but there's no depth to any of it. How do I confront that? How do I confront these things? I think every single one of us, if we're capable of it, needs to lean into this. Sponsoring people is not extra credit. It's not a choice. It's not a choice. It's the only job there is. It's the only real action that there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you'll hear people say, oh, okay, I'll be your sponsor, but don't call me sponsor. There's too much ego in it. I'll just be your friend. And I go, geez, step up, you know? I mean, that's false humility couched in spiritual pride. It's not cute. I'm not impressed, you know? It doesn't do us any good at all to pretend to be humble. You'll never find peace through avoiding life. You know, step up and play your part. Be the sponsor. Be the guy. You don't hear a teacher in a classroom say, "Don't call me teacher, call me Gary. There's too much ego in teacher." You know? What would you think? Shit, you'd move to the next classroom where there was somebody that felt good about himself, you know? So I don't agree with all of that. I think that we have a job to do here. You know, you'll hear people in AA say, "The longer I'm sober, the less I know." What the hell is that? Aren't they paying attention? You know? I mean, you can sit around the rooms, not do a damn thing, and pick some shit up. You know, I mean, you know, that's what I did. You know? I mean, the longer I'm sober, the less I know. False humility, couched in spiritual pride. Not impressive. Don't ask them any questions. They don't know anything. You know? I don't believe it. I'm 24 years sober. I damn well better know some stuff. You know, hopefully I've read the books and seen the movie and, you know, participated a little bit. You pick some stuff up. Just simple life skills. You know, we don't give advice. Please. What kind of advice do we really give when they come to us? You know, I mean, what do we tell them what stocks to invest in? Hopefully not. You know, it's not like that. The guy comes and says, "I've fallen in love with the new dancer down at the Wild Goose. I think I'm going to get married. What do you think?" You know, probably not a really good idea. You know, but I'd rethink that. Let's take a breath, you know, and let's look at that a little bit. But, you know, if you get married, I'll come to the wedding. You know, that's the kind of advice we're giving people. I mean, people come to us, they want our help. I mean, these guys that are leaving my men's group, you know, because we're not a daycare center, why do they think these kids are coming to AA? Because it's so hip? I don't think so. Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I didn't know was available. I mean, you got to lame up just to get this thing, you know? I mean, this isn't hip. AA's not hip. We're not cool. We're not contemporary, you know? This is loser central. I think they're coming here because they need help, because they want help. I think it's as simple as that. And if we take the time with them, with anybody, but especially these kids, I've just fallen in love with them, man. You know, you got to feed them, though. They never have any money. You know? And, but it's not up to me to pick and choose. You know, I don't get to pick and choose. You know, it's up to me to be there for whatever comes into the room, for whatever comes. With no equivocation, no, anybody, absolutely anybody. God, I wish we had more time, but I was maybe 2 years sober, and there was a guy standing in my kitchen, and his mother was dying, and she was in the hospital. He'd been taking care of her for a couple of years. I watched this guy, you know, pop her hip back into place and change her diapers and do all this stuff, and I'd never been around anything like that. And as a matter of fact, I was not in his house. He would just come and talk to me about it. He didn't always do it with a lot of grace, but he was nursing his mother. They didn't have insurance or anything like that. They really had no other choice, and he was the one that was left to do the job, and he did it. And he finally took her to the hospital, and he was standing in my kitchen, and they called him. This is before cell phones. They called him on my phone. He had given him my number because he told him that's where he'd be. And they said, "You better get down here, Al. Doesn't look like she's got much longer to go." So he got up to leave, but he wasn't leaving. And I knew what he wanted, and I didn't want to go. I didn't think I needed to go. I'd never seen anything like that before. It's not my place. I'm just doing this to look good. I didn't want it to be this real. You know, and you can find a lot of people that will co-sign that stuff, that will tell you, yeah, there's limits on what we can do. We're just their sponsors. All we do is read the book with them. Just the black parts only. You know, which is kind of a shame because there's so much in between the lines. And I stood there, and finally I said, "Do you want me to go with you?" And he said, "Would you please?" For some reason, they trust us more than their own family. He had a sister and a brother, you know, and he asked me to go with him. And I didn't know this guy very long, maybe a year, something like that. So I went with him, and we walked in the room, and it was horrible. She's all hooked up to stuff and everything, and I went and I found a chair, and I sat down in this room, and I breathed a little bit. I just breathed. And a feeling came over me. I didn't hear anything. The room didn't change colors, but a feeling came over me, and the feeling was, everything's okay, Bill. There's nothing wrong here. Everything's just as it should be. This is not a mistake. It's just fine. And it was a feeling. And I got him and I said, you know, come over here and sit next to me, Al. And he came over and he sat down. And I looked at him and I said, you know, Al, everything's okay. This is not a mistake. This is the way it's supposed to be. It's all right. Just relax. And I was holding his hands. He's a big guy like me, but he's really a bigger man. He's a carpenter. He's got great big calloused hands. And I was holding his hand and he was gripping my hand really tight because he was upset. And we prayed. We said a prayer. And while we said that prayer, I could feel his hand relax in my hand. That's intimacy. That's intimacy. Emotions, I've come to understand, are very subtle things. And I'm always looking for a head rush. That's what I know. I want to meditate and have all the cells in my body explode through the top of my head, you know? I mean, I'm a child of chaos. If things are like, everything's flying in the air, it makes me feel alive. And I miss stuff like this all the time. All the time I miss this. But this time, I went to a place that I didn't want to go, that I was afraid to go to. And I had this experience with this man. And it changed the course of my life. His mom passed away. A friend of mine called me, a sober friend of mine, who had an 8-year-old son who was dying of leukemia. And it took the boy 2 years to die. He is the same age as my two children that lived in the house with me at the time. They were the same age as my daughter. And I went to the hospital, and I walked in that hospital room where that little boy was dying, and he looked like they look like. They looked like a Dachau poster child. It's just horrendous. It scared the crap out of me. I'd never seen anything like that, and I hung around for a while, and I left that hospital, and I was hyperventilating, and I said, I can't go back in there. I can't do this. I can't hang out there. And I called my sponsor, and my sponsor didn't even know this guy. And I told him what was going on, and he says, well, I'll go with you. I'll go. So we started going to the hospital together. And for the last few months that little boy was alive, we went there almost every day. And our job was to try to give the dad, Chris, a little respite. We would take him outside where he could yell at us. And you know, one of the things that we can bring to a situation like that, us from AA, is we can bring black humor. We can say things in the middle of a situation like that that other people can't get away with and make people laugh nervously. We can tell dead kid jokes and stuff, you know, and other people can't get away with it. But he knows we love him, and he's been to meetings. He knows the black humor in AA. The reason we laugh at the way our lives were is because it's not like that anymore. We've gone through hell, so we tell really good hell jokes. You know, but we're not in hell anymore. And we can bring that to the table, and we can kind of alleviate some of the pressure in the room sometimes. And this is kind of what we did for my friend Chris. And the little boy died. It didn't have a happy ending. And I watched that little boy die, and it changed my life. My friend Patrick Keelahan got lung cancer. Keelahan, his mother called him the devil of all liars. And he was horrible. He would tell his wife that he was going on retreat with us, and he'd go get a 8-ball and a couple of hookers and go down to the Viscount Hotel. He was never in the picture of the retreat, you know. And he was taking birthday cakes in AA, and he hadn't ever been sober. And finally he got sober. Finally he came clean and he got sober. And we started walking the path together. And some years went by, and he got lung cancer, and it took him about 2 years to die. And Jay and I, my sponsor, he was also sponsoring Patrick. We would bring him on retreats that he actually showed up to, and they had an open wound in his back that they used to drain his lungs. And we had to learn how to pack the wound so that we could take him out of the hospital and he could come on retreat with us. He said one of the most powerful things I've ever heard in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He said, if you're not grateful, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. And he was there and he was close to death. And I was there when he died. I was with him when he died. You might remember from my talk Friday night, I told you about hating my father, which is a requirement for AA. And I really hated my father. But when I was a year sober and he had his 70th birthday, I made amends to him. 10 years later, he made amends to me. When I wasn't looking for it, when I didn't need it, when the relationship was safe, don't leave before the miracle. Don't leave. We could never share anything in our lives, but we shared AA. And I found my daddy in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, was he Ward Cleaver? No. He was my daddy. He was my dad. He was the kind of father that never hugged you when you were a kid, but at the end of his life, he couldn't keep his hands off of me. It was incredibly powerful. And I started it. I started hugging him, and then he started hugging me, and we were able to go speak together at meetings sometimes, and we shared Alcoholics Anonymous. He loved AA. And he got cancer. And he decided he wasn't going to do the chemotherapy. And my mother and I nursed him. It took about 6 months. And one day we were standing by the side of his bed, my mother and I, and it was time to change the diaper. And there was no nurse there. He was in the living room of his house. And my mother looked at me and she goes, well, here we go. And we changed his diaper. And I got to see my parents as lovers. They were married 62 years. 62. AA, Al-Anon saved their marriage. Kept my family together. AA and Al-Anon kept my family together when I was 6 years old when he got sober. And I got to see my parents as lovers because she'd seen his butt many times in 62 years, you know. And that's kind of an interesting experience to see that kind of loving kindness. You know, love is work, you know. It's work. It's not an emotion. It's the action that we take towards somebody that we feel strongly towards. And I watched that happen. And we took care of my father. And his light went into the other room, and we had a wonderful memorial. Man, he always had the phone in his hands, and you would call him. And half the time he didn't know who it was, and he didn't care. It didn't matter, you know. It was his people. We'd bring AA meetings to the house, and it was really quite a celebration. It was a sad sweetness. He was 85 years old. He lived a good life. And he died a happy man. And he wasn't balled up in fear and scared to death and screaming and yelling. He was at peace. He was at peace. He was okay. My mother moved in with Karen and I, and then a couple of years after that, she got cancer. She was also 85. And I nursed her by myself in my house, in the living room of my house. We had her in a hospital bed the last couple of months of her life. And one day I'm standing by the side of the bed, and it was time to change the diaper, and nobody else was there. And my mother was a very gorgeous woman. She was always impeccably, she took care of herself, and she looked a lot younger than she really was. And she always was very vain. And you know, so she was in tears, you know, because she thought she had lost her dignity. And she looked at me and she said, I never raised you to do this. And I thought about that and I went, oh, yes, you did. You know, I remember that house I grew up in, that AA house. I know what you people were doing now. You were saving those people's lives. You did raise me to do this. I live in a house just like the one I was raised in now. I have a sober wife. She sponsors a bunch of women. I sponsor a bunch of guys. We try to keep them separated, you know. And she tries to pair them up sometimes, which is... given the gene pool, it doesn't work out very well, you know. And I looked at it and I said, you did raise me to do this. You know, I remember that house. So roll over. You know, and I changed her diapers and we entered into a level of intimacy that we didn't know was available. And it's not the physical part. It's just loving care and kindness, you know, being there for somebody. Now, some of you might be sitting out there thinking, you can't do this. Yes, you can. If I can do it, you can do it. You know, yes, you can do it. We don't run away anymore. We don't run away from things. You know, it's not up to me to pick and choose what I will and won't do. You know, the next time it was a lot easier. The third time she goes, Bill, it's time. You know, and it became part of the work. It just became part of what was going on. And my mother passed away and we had a wonderful memorial. Now, let me ask you this question. The reason I close with this. What if I would have said no to that man in my kitchen that day? What if I hadn't gone to the hospital? Would that have changed everything? I don't know. But it brought something home to me. I cannot figure out how this thing works before it works. I'm not in charge. I'm not the manager. I have no idea that the actions that I take way over here today won't affect my life way over here 10 years later. And that's been my experience. And what brought that home to me, what has taught me these things, what has caused me to confront my defects of character more than anything else, is working with you. And once again, when I get on my knees and I ask for help, He sends me you. He sends me you. And you have to give it away to even get it. Thank you very much.